about 12 years, more than 12 years ago, because I took, when I was in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, our then Prime Minister, Mr. Goh Chok Tong, had an insight that we should have had as a government a long time ago. And that insight is that even if we did our best to ignore the Middle East would not ignore us. So we better learn more about it. And since it's a complicated region, whatever the government did by itself would probably be not enough. You needed some source of independent assessment. We are not a think tank in the sense that we do policy research. We don't make policy recommendations because our researchers are mainly academics and they wouldn't know what a policy looks like, actually, frankly. But they know a lot about the Middle East, and we write papers that give another perspective that helps the policymakers, well, gives them more data to hopefully come up with something sensible. Well, I said that we spent a lot of time, that we didn't have this insight that although we tried to ignore the Middle East will not ignore us. I meant it literally. When I first joined the Foreign Ministry, coming 40 years ago, I'm retired now several times. I like retirement so much that I didn't do it just once, I did it twice. My first job was desk officer for the Middle East. I held that august position for 40 minutes. And then our then permanent secretary, who subsequently became our president, Mr. S.R. Nathan, the late Mr. Nathan, heard about it and was reported to me, said, give the boy a proper job. So I went somewhere else. Okay. And that was pretty much our attitude, frankly. We had two missions in the Middle East. One in Cairo. And the reason we had in Cairo is because, you know, Singapore's political history, we didn't expect to be independent. We didn't want to be independent, but we had independence thrust upon us. And suddenly had to gain recognition from the widest possible spectrum of countries. And Egypt was then a leading light in what was then a much more serious movement called the Non-Aligned Movement. Right? And then we had a consulate in Jeddah because 16%, 17% of our population is Muslim and they go on the Hajj. And that was about it. We were even then an oil refining center, but the oil is brought here by the oil majors. So we didn't really have to bother. What happened? We went from this indifferent attitude to fairly widespread engagement of the Middle East. We, apart from the two missions I mentioned, we have an embassy in Riyadh now. We have a consul general in Dubai. We have an embassy in Abu Dhabi. We have a consul general in Muscat. We have an embassy in Doha. And we have non-resident ambassadors to almost all the Middle East countries, except, let me see, Libya, Syria, and Iraq. Whether you want to consider Afghanistan a Middle East country or not is a debatable matter, but we don't have anything there for the obvious reason, at least when I was the permanent secretary, I couldn't find anybody I disliked enough to send there. You know? Okay. There are three reasons why our attitudes change. Right? First, ideology. We realize that first of all, the trigger, the proximate cause, was when we discovered an Al-Qaeda-linked organization in Southeast Asia, in Singapore, Jamiah Islamiyah. So that was a direct link. We have the goal of establishing a caliphate in Southeast Asia. Singapore was irrelevant. We were expected to disappear once the caliphate was established, but they were planning quite seriously terror attacks in Singapore. Fortunately, we discovered in time, we broke the organization. But we cannot break the ideology. How do you destroy an idea? You can't, really. So it's there. So it went from being And terror is still an issue. We still have, even in Singapore, not an absolutely large number, but a steady number of people inspired by ideologies coming from the Middle East who think it's a jolly good idea to go off and join Daesh, ISIS. And you have it in Southeast Asia, generally there. And in fact, as the ground presence in the Middle East of the Islamic State has been destroyed, and you heard the Syrians had just crushed the last physical holding. But you don't, the idea is still there. They attacked in Afghanistan, they're still active in Iraq, and so on. And they were active not so long ago in southern Philippines, and they're still there. You can't destroy an idea. All the people we have caught in Singapore are self-radicalized. That means they're not part of an organization. But they watch some YouTube, they are influenced by something, and they decide one day something snaps in their mind and decide it's a good idea to go and join this. And this is actually, in a way, harder to deal with than the kind of JI organization that we broke up. Because an organization is an organization. It has a structure, which in principle, at least, you can penetrate, you can break, you can get intelligence, you can break it. But these are people, almost everyone, self-radicalized. And how do you know what's going on in somebody's mind? And we are very fortunate because almost everybody that we have caught, in fact, everybody that we have caught, except the few that slipped away and are somewhere out there, were turned in either by their religious leader or their family, who realized that something was wrong. And we are lucky because the Muslim community, unlike, let's say, in some Western countries, has some trust in the government. And that's why they turn in these people, because they realize these people are the biggest threat of these people pose is to the Muslim community. It's not a strategic threat. It cannot be an existential threat in the sense that they cannot win. They cannot establish a caliphate. There's no way. But they can cause a lot of mayhem along the way. But beyond this terror, direct terror threat, and the terror ideologies, it became clear to us around the same time when we discovered and broke up JI that the way Islam was traditionally conceptualized and practiced in Southeast Asia was changing profoundly under the influence of Middle Eastern variants of Islam. Loosely speaking, I say it's Wahhabism. Okay, there's nothing wrong. You choose to practice your religion in any way you choose. But the problem with this particular thing, it was much more inward-looking. It sought to almost separate the Muslim community from the broader communities in which they are embedded, not just in Singapore, because every Southeast Asian country is pluralistic. And traditional Islam in Southeast Asia had recognized this. It was open, it's highly Sufis, it was syncretic, incorporated elements of, you know, older or different beliefs, but that has changed. I don't think you can reverse this because it's not just a simple matter of some Saudi NGO or Kuwaiti NGO coming here with bags of money and spreading, you know, and financing madrasas or mosques or something. Because we don't allow this in Singapore, and yet you do have the phenomenon, not as severely as in, say, Malaysia. And or even in Indonesia, where it's harder to spot because it's much more, until recently it was harder to spot because it's much a vaster country, but it's there. And so we have to better understand it in order to deal with it. Not to tell people how to practice their own religion, but to try to temper its harder edges, try to get, there are many understandings of Islam, there's not only one understanding. Some of you who are Singaporeans must have watched PM's National Day rally speech where he did mention we are going to start Singapore Islamic College, right? And that's really the background to this. And it's not just Muslims, by the way. Certain variants of I would call radical evangelical Christianity are also heavily influenced by the Middle East or what happens in the Middle East. Give you one example. I can't go into too much detail because the police are investigating. One of our researchers, who is an international lawyer, has received email threats from groups purportedly evangelical who objected to him studying, or to object to his conclusion that the Trump administration's recognition of Jerusalem is questionable, to say the least, under international law. And they sent him threats. And the threats can be traced to public computers not so far from here. Okay. So Middle East does have an influence on identity, not just Muslim identity, Singapore identity. And this is as serious a threat as the direct threat of terror. In fact, I would argue it's probably a more serious threat, because Singapore's common identity is only 54 years old. And we live in an age where identities of various kinds, not just religious identities, ethnic identities, secular identities, are being asserted throughout the world. And it would be foolish to think that we are somehow magically exempt from these trends. I think one of the reasons for this is that most Singaporeans are not particularly interested in international relations, not particularly interested in the Middle East, and insofar as they're interested, have rather simple views of the Middle East. It's a very complicated region. Nothing is simple. The second reason is economics. Our first reason for taking a closer interest in the Middle East was essentially defensive. Things from there are influencing us and countries around us in ways that were not always very healthy, so better understand. That's essentially defensive. But as we began to engage the Middle East more deeply, and former Prime Minister Goh Chok Tong took the lead in this, we discovered that there were positive interests too, mainly economic. That while we had been ignoring, in particular, the Gulf states, they had not been ignoring us. They had been studying our experience very carefully to see what lessons they could possibly take for their own economic development. And that created some opportunity for some of our businesses who have taken advantage of it. But there's another aspect which is, again, defensive. You all must have know that the US and Iran are in a confrontation in the Gulf. There have been attacks on tankers and so on. And this is going to be a long-term thing, because I think the consensus of opinion among most people is that neither Iran nor the US wants a war. But neither is going to give up, so this is going to be very, very prolonged. Which means that uncertainty in the Gulf, and that Straits of Hormuz is where most of the oil that comes to our part of the world and further north comes from. And there is an immediate knock-on effect, higher insurance rates, and eventually maybe higher oil price, which will translate immediately into electricity price, and things like that. Now, this geopolitical factor, US-Iran confrontation, which is Saudi Arabia-UAE confrontation with Iran and Qatar, obviously is not very helpful to a world economy that is already very fragile, and made more fragile as we speak by the US-China trade tensions. So it's another factor. It has a positive factor, there's a negative factor. And even in this negativity, there's some opportunity, because there are Middle Easterners and Central Asians, this institute also studies Central Asia, who are very interested in Singapore's wealth management capabilities. And there's opportunity there. And I think some of our financial institutions do recognize it, but they are rather nervous because they don't know very much about the Middle East. I'll tell you a story. Just 2 days ago, CEO of a bank, a friend of mine who works for this bank asked me, said the CEO heard of you, wants to talk to you. And because they were interested in doing wealth management in some Middle East, Central Asian countries, and there was demand there. I mean, it's not that they went looking, people came looking for them, but they were very nervous. They were very nervous because they knew nothing about these things. They were very nervous whether they could abide by compliance rules and things like that. But I told them, look, you know, you're only nervous. This what in this respect is no different, say, from China or Indonesia, right? You can work there, you can work here. The only reason is I can see is that you know something about China and Indonesia, you know nothing about these countries. So there are still, in this fragile world economy, some opportunities. And the third reason is, of course, geopolitics. It seems far away, but some of the geopolitical developments in the Middle East do have an almost direct bearing on geopolitical developments in our region. This U.S.-Iran confrontation, in the which I just mentioned, is one symptom, a kind of proxy for a broader strategic realignment that is going around, that is going on even as we speak. Is the U.S. in retreat? I don't think the U.S. is in retreat if you take the word literally. But the U.S. certainly has a new attitude, because the period when the U.S. was the sole and preeminent global power and regional power was historically a very short and exceptional period, maybe from 1991 to something like 2009. More normally, the world is divided between competing major powers. More normally, the region, including our region, has been divided, and we are returning to this period of normalcy, and it's not the same U.S. Mr. Trump is a symptom of something larger. So things that happen in the Middle East are, in a sense, a proxy for things that will affect us sooner or later. I'll give you a couple of examples. Mr. Obama drew a red line in Syria over the use of chemical weapons and failed to enforce it. That immediately degraded American credibility in this part of the world that relies on American military presence as one of the foundations of stability in this part of the world. Because if you are a great power and you say you're going to do something, you better do it. Because if not, your credibility will be degraded. Conversely, when Mr. Trump, while having dinner with Mr. Xi Jinping, decided to bomb Syria over the same issue, chemical weapons, he did quite a lot to restore credibility. And that's important for an issue that's of immediate relevance to our region, that's North Korean issue. I think there's no doubt that the American deterrence of North Korea degraded significantly under the Obama administration, because he did nothing, basically. He talked a good talk, he made very nice speeches, but essentially he did nothing. But then when Mr. Trump in Syria and through his rhetoric demonstrated that he was willing to use force, I think it did a lot to restore credibility. And it's not a guess of mine. During the 8 years of the Obama administration, that is when the long-range North Korean missile program and their nuclear program really took off. And they're not stoppable now. If they're not stoppable, how you deal with a nuclear power? They are a nuclear power. You can only deal with nuclear power one way, through deterrence. Right? And Mr. Trump's restoration of the credibility of American deterrence is very important. And it works, I tell you why. Kim Jong-un has been cleverer than anybody thinks. But he also gets carried away. And he got carried away when he threatened to bracket Guam with their long-range missiles. And Mr. Trump threatened fire and fury on him. And ever since then, he did not stop long-range missile testing immediately, but he tested on a very high trajectory that went nowhere near Guam or any American possession. And even to today, he has only tested short-range missiles. So there is some, and I don't think he would have done that unless he believed Mr. Trump, and one of the reasons, I'm not saying the only reason, is Mr. Trump's willingness to use force against Syria over an issue where Obama said he would and didn't. The nuclear deal, the JCPOA, that's a positive example. I'll give you a negative example. When Trump unilaterally canceled the JCPOA or pulled the Americans out, no, look, you know, Singapore is not directly involved in this issue. We can't be. We're not there. We don't have the expertise to be involved. But what was the issue for us when he unilaterally pulled himself out? or the JCPOA. The issue is sanctity of international agreements. It's a very fundamental principle of what little order there is in the international things, that agreements signed once must be honored. It doesn't matter if it's signed by this government, I don't like this government, I inherited it, I have to honor it. If I don't like the agreement, I renegotiate it. I don't just unilaterally discard it. And that also says something in a negative way about the credibility of American commitments. Now, I could go on, but I told you I don't want to have a monologue. So these are among some of the reasons, broadly, why we should be interested in the Middle East. I mean, not that all of us are going to become Middle East experts, yeah? But we should at least take an intelligent interest in it, because it does affect our lives. Affects our lives in terms of social cohesion, affects our lives in terms of our livelihood, economics, and it affects our lives in terms of the broader strategic picture, which we cannot divorce ourselves from.